So for this morning's talk, when I teach at a retreat, there's people from all different levels of understanding, achievements in meditation, from the very beginners to those who are already fully enlightened. Maybe? Anyone here? All the different levels. And so I have to sort of aim the talks at all levels and every now and again give an easy talk, a deep talk, somewhere in between. But today I wanted to go over what the Buddha taught about the meditation, especially Anapanasati, the mindfulness of the breath. Again, it's another meditation talk. It's covering the same ground, but from a different angle. And every time that you cover the same ground, but from different angles, you get different perspectives, more understanding, and obviously a fuller map of the territory of meditation. But now throughout this retreat, that's basically all we ever talk about, is just how to meditate. I don't like telling people about what they're going to find when they get to the end of that part, because that is just going on to beliefs. It's telling you how to find out for yourself, how to meditate, how to make the mind peaceful, how to make it still and clear, so you can see what yourself what's going on. So when I say I was been brainwashing you, yes, I have been brainwashing you, but not in the sense of putting in new ideas into your head, but just to take out all the old ideas, to literally wash you clean, so you can actually see things as they truly are, instead of having things being bent or distorted. So, when the Buddha taught meditation, the most popular type of meditation which he taught was the meditation on the breath. And for the last 2,500-600 years, that is the meditation which most people do. That's the meditation which the Buddha did when he sat under a tree and became enlightened. And that's why we have meditation retreat centers in forests, so you've got lots and lots of trees to sit underneath, and one day you might become enlightened as well. If you don't actually sit under a tree, because it's very uncomfortable being in the bush with all these insects crawling all over you and flies, we actually put a tree underneath you with the bamboo and the wood on the top of you. So that's just about like having a tree above you. So you, in one sense, you are sitting under a tree with the wooden ceiling. So it works the same way to get you enlightened. And this particular tree you're standing under is air conditioned, so it's even easier to become enlightened. There is the meditation which the Buddha always recommended. And so I'm going to go through this, but you know, point out some parts of it which you may not have heard before, aspects of it which will make it very clear what you're doing and why you're doing it. And most importantly is because, you know, it ties what I teach down to what the Buddha taught, so you never really think that, oh, Ajahn Brahm is making this up by himself. It's not just changing anything, but it's just elaborating in modern language what's right there in the Buddha's teachings. Now, in this Anapanasati Sutta, it starts off, you know, with a person just finds a nice quiet place to meditate in. And a quiet place is very necessary when you begin to meditate. Later on, you can meditate in very noisy places. The noisiest place I've ever meditated in, many, many, many years ago, the Burmese community were having a silent peace protest for the situation in Burma. I think that was the first of those student demonstrations where many students were massacred. And they decided to have like a Buddhist protest, so just to sit down on the street and meditate for a couple of hours. And so they asked me to come along, and it was meditated, no cushions, on the concrete pavement, and it was opposite a shop called Time Zone. You know, that's where they have these games, and there's this music blasting out all the time, and the trucks and the cars going past, and people right in the middle of Perth in Hay Street. And I thought, that's really great, because, you know, see if you can really meditate in the middle of so much noise, you know, in the middle of the city. So you can do that if you know how to do that, and that's where you don't disturb the noise. You just let the noise be, just don't really be concerned with it, and because you're not concerned with it, not trying to get rid of it, not trying to control it, not getting angry at it, it soon vanishes and disappears. Whatever you are not really concerned about, whatever's not a problem, vanishes from your mind. The only reason it comes into your mind and stays there is because you think it's important. It's a problem, it's something to deal with. But you really realise, oh, you can't even deal with it, it's a waste of time, then it vanishes from your field of perception. It's very fascinating what comes into our mind and why. And sometimes that you can reflect on that. Somebody's having a conversation, why do I have to listen to it? It's got nothing to do with me at all. Now, a crow starts doing its thing, and it's very sort of unpleasant. Why do I even bother listening to that crow? Nothing to do with me. Someone coughs. It's not my cough. Why do I have to listen to it? To bang the door, it's not my door. Why do I bother with it? And it's interesting, the reason why we bother with these things is because we really get involved, we try and control them, we try and make a problem out of them, and that's when they really obsess our mind. For those of you who still got problems with these things, thoughts in the mind, emotions in your body, sounds and heat or cold, all these irritating things of life, you know, we really try hard to make this retreat center irritation free. You know, we can have an aircon in here to make sure it's a nice temperature for you. You've got lovely beds, your own rooms, toilets and showers. But the one irritating thing which we can't do anything about is each one of you. So if you had this retreat center all by yourself and no one else, then maybe it would be irritation free. But other people are always getting at you. So, you can't make anything that perfect. So the simile I like to practice, I've already mentioned one simile, like being the lotus leaf. Now, whatever falls on it, you know, perfume or urine, it just all falls off, leaving no residue. In other words, it's like the cinema. I wrote a little story in the Opening the Door of Your Heart book. It's a very brilliant little story. It's one of my best friends. You know, went to school together with him. And he told me he was going off into Jamaica many, many years ago, maybe 35 years ago now. And you know, Jamaica has the highest murder rate in the whole world. It's a very, very violent country. So he went to one of the violent cities, you know, up country in Jamaica. And you know, with a friend, so he was reasonably safe. But one evening, after dinner, they went to a movie. And it was one of these drive-in movie theatres, which they used to have in the old days. You know, it's a big screen, you go in the car there, and they put a little microphone thing on your window so you can get the soundtrack, and you see the movie on this big, huge screen. Only in this movie theatre, the screen was made out of concrete. A really thick concrete. It must have cost a fortune. It was the first time he ever seen a drive-in movie theatre with a concrete screen rather than the usual canvas screen. So he asked his friend, why is there a concrete screen here? And this was the answer. It was a very violent town, and in that town, they loved violent movies. You know, cowboy and westerns, you know, the cops and robbers, those sorts of movies. And whenever there was a gunfight on the screen, the people in the audience would get out their guns as well and join in. Bang, bang, bang. And they're shooting the sheriff, shooting the cop, shooting the robber, whoever they didn't like. And they'd join in. And they'd shot through so many canvas screens. The owner of this cinema, this is a wonderful true story, decided to build a concrete screen so all the patrons could go in there with their guns, and when they got interested and excited, they'd join in, bang, bang, and have a, you know, really good time. You know, interactive cinema at its best. And that was there, that was happening. But it just shows, why do you want to get involved in the movie? It's just a movie on a screen, that's all. You know, you're just in the car or in the seat. What's the big deal? But do you get involved in the movies? You know, they're creeping up. Bang, 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 bang. And you get excited and you love that. You know, oh, it's romantic. The boy meets the girl after so many difficulties. And they fall in love and live happily. Oh, isn't that sweet? You know what's going to happen in the end of these movies. But it's only a movie. Now, why do people in the audience cry during a movie? You know, it's not a real thing. No one really gets killed. And it's not sort of, no one really falls in love. You know, it's just acting. But we love to get involved in it. And that's the reason why that whatever's happening outside, it is none of your business, but we love getting involved. We love distracting ourselves. That's why that people, you know, they like reading romance or thrillers. You know, they like sort of seeing all of these soap operas on the TV. They like to get involved in things because they're afraid of peace and letting go. And that's one of the reasons why, whether it's hot, whether it's cold, whether it's quiet or whether it's noisy, we love getting involved so much that no matter how you devise this retreat centre, if you make it absolutely perfect, you'll always find something to complain about. Why? Because you like complaining. It's an addiction to fault finding. So after a while we let go of that addiction to fault finding. At least leave it alone. No, it's hot, that's good enough. It's cold, that's good enough. It's noisy, that's good enough. It's pretty good here. It could be better, but this is good enough for meditating. So, you know, you've made as much as best you can, now sit down and relax, enjoy it. So you try and find a nice, reasonably quiet, comfortable place. And in this joint, there's many places you can meditate. If you really get hot today or the next day, go and sit in your shower and let the water sort of on or something. Sort of keep yourself cool. Put a wet cloth over you or whatever. So whatever you want to do, there's so many places you can meditate in this retreat center. So many things you can do. This. So be adaptable, be resourceful. And once you find that quiet, reasonable place, you sit down comfortably. The posture is, now it begins with Anapanasati. You don't have to sit in full lotus. You don't have to have your back straight, as I was saying the other day. However, there is one very important part of your posture, the one which is very crucial to getting into deep meditation or not. And it doesn't really matter where you put your hands, you know, Tibetan style, Thai style, or on your head like at school, I don't know where you put your hands. But the most important part of your posture is what's happening right under your nose, your mouth posture. Because sometimes I've opened my eyes during this meditation retreat, and I've seen people with bad mouth posture. Gritting their teeth, being upset. So the correct mouth posture for meditation is a smile. Turn the corners upwards. People put a lot of effort training their legs to sit in full lotus, training their back to be straight, training this. But the one thing you should be training yourself in with mouth posture for meditation. And it really does make a difference. The rest of the stuff is a waste of time. It doesn't matter where you put your legs or where your back is. But your mouth, yes. Because if your mouth is showing signs of suffering, pain, frustration, it shows you what your mind is doing. No way can you get deep meditation that way. And sometimes all you need to do is deliberately make your mouth smile. If you can't make a smile, make one. And you do that, and this is actually a very good little technique. You're getting nowhere in meditation, or you get blocked somewhere. Take your attention away from whatever object you're focusing on and put it onto your mouth. Turn the corners upwards. Little smile. And you find that will be a trigger of happiness, piti sukha, inside the mind. It will brighten the mind up. And from that you can often just go into very deep meditation. Because when the mouth smiles, it brings the corresponding sense of joy to the mind. So now when the face smiles, the mind also smiles as well. And it works. So try that posture. And it's out of compassion for me, the other monks and nuns who have to face you all day. Sometimes it's so depressing I go back and want to kill myself. No, I don't. But anyhow, so that's the posture, finding a nice quiet place. The next thing it says in Anapanasati is, they say this word, setting up mindfulness in front of you. And that has been so confusing to so many people for so many centuries or years. And one of the reasons is because a lot of people don't know the Pali and they just translate it. And in front of you does not mean in front of your nose or in front of your mouth or in front of anywhere. It is like the idiom. It means giving it importance, giving it priority. That's actually what the word priority means. A prior is someone who stands in front. So, yes, spatially, the symbol is you put it in front. But that is a metaphor for making it the most important. The first on the list, the top priority, the number one thing to do, to establish mindfulness straight away. Before you start watching your breathing. And I think that you've all got that point, because I made that point very early on in this retreat. Even before you start trying to watch the breath, make sure you're mindful first of all. Otherwise, you try and watch the breath and you just don't have the tools. The skill has not been developed yet to watch the breath. It's just like an athlete has to warm up before they start the game, the contest. And so this is actually warming up the mindfulness. And how do you do that? Again, present moment awareness and silence. Because that's really what mindfulness means. Basic mindfulness. You're here. Because if you're thinking of the past and if you're thinking of the future, you're not here. You're not aware. You don't know what's going on. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, people could, you know, fall into manholes, they can trip over. They're not really where they are and what they're doing. They're somewhere else. So you're right here with what you're doing. Present moment awareness. Mindfulness. And also the silence of the mind. Then you're aware of what's going on, rather than aware of the description of what's going on. You're aware of the reality of now, rather than all the labels of now. And the labels can be very, very deceiving. So we're aware right now what's going on with silence. And it is worthwhile spending a lot of time in preparation. Building this retreat center, most of the work was actually leveling the ground and putting the foundations and the slabs up. The rest of the stuff, once you've got the foundations, and the foundations are very strong, the rest is reasonably quick. But those foundations are crucial to any building. It's the same, the painters tell me that most of the work, painting a wall or painting a ceiling, is a preparation. Cleaning it, sanding it, smoothing it, and then when they actually put the paint on, it's very, very quick. But the preparation is most important. And that's why the preparation with mindfulness, first of all. Get yourself here. And the other part of that preparation is resting. That's why the first few days of these retreats, I encourage you, now have rest, have naps, whenever you, however much you need. Because it takes time to get enough energy to get rid of the sleep deficit so that you feel energized, enough that your mindfulness is strong to be able to see the breath. So that's actually the basics, and it's really good spending time on those basics. If you're still tired, then still rest. It doesn't matter how long you sleep. It's much better that you sleep 23 hours and you have 1 hour where you meditate and get enlightened, rather than have 1 hour of sleep and 23 hours of pain and suffering. So, you know, quality rather than quantity is important. And I think by now you should feel that. If your body's not at ease, it's very hard to get your mind at ease. So you get your body nice and easy. And once you have all those preparations, then you start the breath meditation. You know, first of all, I'm just going through the steps as the Buddha taught. If you're breathing in long, you know it's long. Breathing out long, you know it's long. Breathing in short, you know it's short. Breathing out short, you know it's short. And some people think, oh, I've got to do number one first, breathing in long. Now I've got to do short. And they think, you know, they've got to do one after the other because that's how we've been brought up. No, these are just examples of when you're first watching the breath. You know, just watching the breath go in and out sometimes is not enough to interest the mind. So you've got to add something else just to make it a little bit more interesting and fascinating, so the mind can actually watch it without wandering off. So in and out is not enough. So you can just see how long it is or how short it is. You don't have to do one or the other. It can be in the middle, not long, not short. It could be a tiny bit more long than short. It can be 72% long, and only 20%, or whatever it is. So it just gives you something to watch. And this is where there's many alternatives to those two stages of anapanasati. It doesn't have to be long or short. This is where you can start doing the mantras with the breath, words which you say along with the breath, just to give your mind something to hold on to, a hook to attach to the breath for the time being. Little mantras, like in Thailand, they use a Buddha mantra, breathing in Buddha, breathing out Tho, because to them that was a very powerful word. And I say here, for Westerners, that doesn't usually work because, you know, you haven't got the same sort of cultural feeling for the word Buddha. So for the Westerners, I've already mentioned the favorite mantra for breathing in with a word. You breathe in and you say, shut. Yeah, breathe out, up. Shut. Because it reminds you to be quiet. Well, the other one which I mentioned to you, breathing in, you can say breathe in peace, breathe out, letting go. Breathe in peace, breathe out, let go. Now those actually help, because they just make it slightly more complicated, give you a little bit more things to occupy your mind. And for a Westerner, or a person brought up in Western countries, peace is a very beautiful meaning. So you breathe in peace, and that's really important to you. That's valuable, so it's very easy for the mind to actually to focus on that, breathing in peace. That's great. And letting go is also really important. Because the air is being exhaled, the breathing out, let go, it fits. Breathing in peace, breathing out, letting go. That's very beautiful. Other alternatives, for those of you who are environmentally sensitive, you can imagine that the air which you're breathing in is a gift from all that is green in our environment, because that's where most of the oxygen comes from the plants, from the trees, from the grasses. So you breathe in a gift from nature, oxygen, and you breathe out carbon dioxide, which is your gift back to all that's green in this forest, what they need to survive. So your breath is connecting you with all that's green and alive in this forest where we're meditating. Breathing in a gift from the trees. Breathing out my gift to the flowers. That can be quite nice. It just adds that tiny little bit of extra to the breath, just to make it interesting at this beginning stage of meditation. If that doesn't work, for those of you who are scientists, accountants, mathematicians, you can count the breath. So counting the breath, there's so many different ways to count the breathing. For those of you who want to try this method, because remember I did maths at Cambridge, so I always complicate things when it comes to maths. So, I breathe in, I note one, out one, in two, two, three, three. Natural breaths, however long or short they want to be. 4, 4, 5, 5, 6, 6, 7, 7, 8, 8. Breathing in 9, out 9. I stop at 9. Then I start at 1 again. Breathing in 1, out 1, in 2, out 2. It's amazing how many people pay attention when I'm doing this, because it's nice and complicated. At last you've got something complicated to do. Breathing in 3, out 3, 4, 4, 5, 5, 6, 6, 7, 7. Breathing in 8, breathing out 8. I only go to 8 this time. Then I start again at 1, breathing in 1, out 1, in 2, out 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 5, 5, 6, 6, to 7. You got it already now. In 1, out 1, 2, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 5, 5, in 6, out 6. In 1, out 1, in 2, out 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 5. In 1, out 1, in 2, out 2, in 3, out 3, in 4, out 4. In 1, out 1, in 2, out 2, in 3, out 3. In 1, out 1, in 2, out 2, in 1, out 1. One whole cycle of 45 breaths. And it gives you something to do. I know you're not supposed to be doing something. At least you're doing something which is half useful. Only half useful. But it gets you in contact with the breath and gives you something to do, something to play with. Now, if you try that, that will actually show you how mindful you are. Because what will usually happen, especially if you try doing that first thing in the morning, is you find yourself saying, cause this is what happened to me when I started doing this, breathing out 17, breathing out 17, breathing in 18, out, uh-oh, I've lost last I forgot to stop. Or breathing out six, breathing out one. What number am I in? Because it takes a lot of awareness to actually know where you are, know what number you're supposed to be doing and going up to. It just makes it a little bit more interesting. Gives you something more to do. But please don't do that for too long. Because it just gives you a headache after a while, counting all day. So just a little bit is enough. Just enough to get you in contact with your breath. And once you can just notice the breath go in, go out, in, go out. And it doesn't disappear. In other words, you've got enough stability, you can watch your breath, maybe for 100 breaths or 150 breaths, and you don't really lose any. You don't go wandering off all over the place and wondering where you've been. You've got the breath. That's those first two stages of Anapanasati. You're focusing. But remember, focusing never works by force because you can't maintain it. Focusing is like resting the breath in your hand. Like resting a flower in your hand. If you hold it too tight, you crush it. If it's too loose, it falls away. So just that right amount of effort, just so you can hold the breath. Now sometimes people want to put a little bit of effort into your meditation. It's best not to, but if you want to, you can at the beginning. It's not so crucial at the beginning of the meditation to put some effort in, to try. But don't go on too long. Loosen off the effort as soon as possible. So yeah, you know, you're holding on to the breath, but then loosen off as soon as you can. And you'll find that the more you let go, the easier it is to hold the breath. It just stays there. And once it stays there, once you have the breath as your focus, you can have many other things in your mind at the same time, but the breath is at the center of your field of attention. And this is where I come to the TV simile. When you watch your TV at home, in the old days when I used to watch a TV, it was a box rather than just a flat screen. And on the top of the box would be the picture of, you know, your mum and dad's wedding or something, or of their kids. And underneath it would have magazines and have flowers on the side somewhere. And one thing I remembered, when I watched that TV, when it was first turned on, I could see the photo on top of the TV. I could see the magazines underneath. But after a minute or two, I could not see the photo on top, nor the magazines underneath anymore. I couldn't even see the edges of the screen. I didn't know whether it was a square screen, or a round screen, or a diamond screen. Those of you who want to get some money and make a small fortune, why not have weird TV screens? Not rectangular, because everyone's got those. How about circular TV screens? Designer TV screens. Have you ever seen a circular TV screen in the shop? Because it's new, it'll become fashionable. And you can make a fortune that way. Have a circle. How about a triangular TV screen? No, for the Jewish community, a Star of David TV screen. That would be really popular. Why not? Because actually it won't make any difference. Once that TV screen is turned on, you won't recognize the edges or its shape. You just go right into the center of that TV screen. So next time you watch the TV, notice that. When it's not turned on, you can see the edges and beyond the edges, but once it's turned on, you go right into the center of that TV screen, you can't see any edges anymore. Because you can't see any edges, just like when you're watching me, you can't see any edges, can you, to that screen? And that's what happens when you watch a movie or a TV documentary. It's exactly the same experience. That gives it the sense of authenticity. There's no boundary on it, on the TV, once you get into it. There's no boundary of your life. There's no frame. And that gives it the authenticity. Now, the reason I say that is because that's what happens when you start watching the breath. When you start watching the breath, you can see the breath. You can also see these other things, you know, the photo on top of the magazines underneath. You know, the feelings in the body, the sounds, you know, the heat, the cold, all these other distractions, they're there. Now you don't need to get rid of those distractions. All you need to do is keep the center with the breath. or rather keep the breath in the center. So the breath in the center, the sound, it sounds over here somewhere. It's hot, but the heat's over there somewhere. The middle is the breathing. Because what happens if there's a sound or a feeling, an ache in the body, and if that is a problem, that takes center screen for you. And then the breath falls off the edge. But if you keep the breath in the center, just, you can have the sound, the heat, the noise, whatever, but keep the breath in the center there. And after a while, just like watching the TV, that's all that's there, just the breath. And things on the edge have fallen off the edge of the screen. That's what I did in Hay Street, Mao, when I was meditating for that Burmese demonstration, or whatever they called it. Yeah, the noise was there, but in the center was my breath. And soon, the noise fell off the screen. Just like watching a movie, the edge of the screen just disappears as you focus in. That's what focusing means. So that's how you deal with distractions. You don't try and get rid of them, but you don't keep them on the center of your screen. You keep your meditation object at the center of the screen, and then you wait, and soon everything else disappears. And because everything else disappears, the feelings in the body, the sounds, whatever, they don't actually totally disappear, but they're at a distance. You know, it's like 100 miles away, or maybe not that far, but you know, it's a distance away. Yeah, you can feel heat, but it's over there, inside you with your breath, and it fills your screen. And the breath filling your screen, that's experiencing the whole breath, which I mentioned the other day. Beginning of the in-breath to the end of the in-breath. And in order to help you, there is a little meditation test for you. I want you to find out the answer to this problem. Which is longer, the space between the in-breath and the next out-breath, or the space between the out-breath and the in-breath? Because there's a pause. The in-breath is finished. The out-breath is yet to begin. There's a pause there. Or the out-breath is finished and the in-breath has yet to come. There's another pause. Which is the longest? Now you have to find that out. Makes it interesting, doesn't it? Like a little test. But what it really does mean, it means you have to really pay attention to the breath, every moment of it. In other words, it starts to fill your mind. So all you've got is the breath. Now, a lot of people might think that's boring, but to be able to do that, you have to have enough mindfulness, enough stillness, that the energy is now really going into the mind. You can't do very much. You have to wait and be still to watch this breath. Because you're waiting and being still, you're not doing anything, mindfulness starts to get the energy. And the breath does become very satisfying. You do start to get the joy. The first little bits of joy. And the next, that's number three stage of Anapanasati. Sapakayapati Sangvedi. You experience the whole of the breath. As I mentioned, the whole body, the whole aggregate of breathing. Nothing to do with the physical body. Physical body is a pain and is always disturbing you. And I'll never mention, I mentioned it early, you don't watch the breath at the tip of the nose, you don't watch the breath at the belly, you don't watch the breath anywhere, you watch the breath. You know that sometimes it's like a person like the CIA and they're following a suspect and they're following this guy. And he goes into the women's toilets. What should he do? Guys aren't supposed to go into the girls' toilets. But this spy did. So this suspect did. So the spy has to follow the suspect wherever it goes. If the suspect goes in the girls' toilets, the CIA guy has to go in the girls' toilets as well. And the reason I mention that is, if you're going to follow the breath, yeah, the breath is supposed to be at the tip of the nose. It's supposed to be at the belly. But sometimes it's not. Sometimes it hides, sometimes it goes to places where it shouldn't be. And if you're going to follow the breath, you have to go wherever the breath goes. Not where it's supposed to be, but where it actually is. So that's why the little method of, am I breathing in, am I breathing out? I know that. How do I know that? There's a sensation of feeling somewhere inside of you which tells you what the breath is doing. And that's the feeling. And I found it very effective not to to locate it anywhere in my body. Well, actually, when it settles down, it usually is on the tip of the nose. But only when I ask the question, where is that? Oh, it's tip of the nose. But a lot of the time, that particular perception of its location on the body, I just don't pay any attention to at all. And the benefit of that is the body disappears much quicker that way. Because if you're watching the tip of the nose, you may get itchy on the nose, you may sneeze. If you're watching on the belly, you may cough. You've got your body awareness. And the idea here is to let go of the body so it can disappear, so you can have a bit of freedom and peace. So you're watching the whole of this breath going in and going out. Now the next stage is that you calm that breath down. How do you do that? You achieve that next stage, stage four, by not doing anything. If you try to calm things down, it gets more agitated. You leave it alone and it calms down by itself. That's a classic of how do I calm down the water in this cup. You put it down, let it go, and it calms all by itself. And that's what happens. That fourth stage of Anapanasati is just the breath starts to get smooth. You're watching the whole breath, and it calms down all by itself. What happens next? What do you mean by it calms down? When it calms down, it's not much of a problem anymore. It's still, it's smooth, it's even. It sort of starts to disappear. At least the in and out part of it is not the most prominent part anymore. Instead, the delight is the most important part. In the Anapanasati Sutta, the Buddha actually said, those first four steps, he said, that fulfills the Satipatthana, the mindfulness of body. Because the breath is just a physical thing. And it's fulfilled it. You've seen the breath. And the next Satipatthana, mindfulness of these feelings, the quality of every sensory experience of pleasure or pain, that's what now begins. It now becomes not watching the breath, but watching the feeling, the joy. And these are really important parts of Anapanasati. And this is one of the reasons I'm teaching this, because this emphasizes these next stages as crucial to the meditation, as taught by the Buddha. Breathing in, breathing out, you develop piti. Breathing in, breathing out, you develop sukha. Piti sukha, this joy and happiness. What I just call the delightful breath. This is where you calm the breath down, and it becomes just so delightful. The in and out part of it is just not really important anymore. It's just so delightful. Oh, it's just so nice. That becomes a prominent object of your meditation. When people ask, what are you watching? Well, I'm watching the breath, but what I'm really watching is the delight of the breath. You're enjoying yourself. The piti, the sukha is what is filling your mind. And of course, this is such a beautiful part of the meditation, because now you're having fun. Some of you, you know, in your little questions you ask, say, oh, it's so difficult, you're getting tired, you're getting bored, nothing has happened yet, blah, blah, blah. Isn't it wonderful when you start getting into this beautiful meditation stage where you're having great fun? You sit here and just enjoying every moment of it, as some of you have. Now that is what is supposed to happen. That's fifth and sixth stages according to the Buddhism. This is where the meditation becomes joyful. So when it happens, well done, it's supposed to happen. Still, there's too many meditation teachers say, oh, you're enjoying yourself, that must be bad, you get attached, stop it immediately, stop it, stop it, stop it. I thought, what's wrong with having fun? Especially meditation fun, the Buddha said there's no problem at all. That I mentioned already, that you should not be afraid of that piti sukha which comes up in meditation. Make much of it, develop it, follow it. And any monk or teacher, nun or whatever, who says you'll get attached to those stages, say yes, you will get attached to the happiness of meditation. But then quote Pasadika Sutta of Digha Nikaya, one of my favorite little quotes, where the Buddha said, anyone who gets attached to the pleasures of meditation, They can expect only one of four consequences. This is the only things which can happen to you if you get attached to the pleasures of meditation. Only four possibilities, not five. And the four possibilities of people who get attached to the pleasure of meditation are stream winning. That's the first stage of enlightenment. Once returning, that's the second stage of enlightenment. Non-returning, that's the third stage of enlightenment. Or full enlightenment, number four. Those are the four possibilities of being attached to the pleasure of meditation. You get enlightened. That's what we're supposed to be doing. So go for it. I don't know why it is. In religion especially, of all human endeavours, people are so afraid of pleasure. Somebody once said the definition of Puritanism, now that was that type of Christianity which went to the United States with the Pilgrim Fathers, which still really dominates their country. The definition of Puritanism is the fear that somewhere someone is happy. That's brilliant. So you can be happy in meditation. And little piece of evidence number two. I'm just quoting Buddhism now. These are my favourite quotes, so you've heard them before. Dhammacetti Sutta, the monuments to the Dhamma. That's where the King Pasenadi, one of the chief disciples of the Buddha, just before he passed away, he went to see the Buddha in the Jeta Grove Monastery, the Jetavana Monastery. And he went into the Buddha's hut, bowed at his feet. He actually started kissing his feet. Now the king kissing the feet of a monk. So please don't you try and do that, because I wouldn't if I was you. I did have a shower this morning, but you know, I do not wear my shoes when I'm walking up and down this place, so please don't do that. You might catch something very bad. But the king didn't mind. He was kissing the Buddha's feet. And he said, "What the heck are you doing, king?" And he said something like, "Oh, I just love coming to see you. And I just love this monastery. You know, this has been my great joy. You know, because my city is just within walking distance of the Jetavana Monastery, and they've got this great teacher, the Buddha, and I love you so much. And I love coming to this monastery." And the Buddha said, "Why do you love coming to this monastery?" And that's where this king sentence is written down in these ancient sutras. "Because when I come into this monastery, all the monks are happy and smiling." And the Buddha said, "Yes, that's what's supposed to happen when your meditation starts to progress, when you start to get insights. You're supposed to be happy and smiling, great king." And I love that, because it actually showed what happens when meditation starts to work. You become happy and smiley. That's why when people come and interview and say, "I've just got fourth jhana, I've just got stream winning, I just don't believe a word of it. I just look for their face." And if they've got this big smile, they go, "Oh, okay, yeah, maybe you've got it." If it's not that bliss and that happiness there, you haven't got the deep meditation, you haven't got the insights yet. And that's actually straight from the word of the Buddha. So in this stage, you're developing that joy and happiness. Now do you understand why I teach like I do? I'm encouraging that joy. Sadhu, 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 the three stupid sadhus, which I keep doing. I'm trying to develop that piti sukha, make it fun and happy for you. And when I'm encouraging that, after a while you just give in. I mean, a few people resist. No, I'm serious. I'm a serious meditator. Piti sukha is what is supposed to happen. And eventually you give in and it does happen. You become very joyful and smiley. That's the fifth and sixth stages of Anapanasati. And it's crucial. Many people have heard me say that's the pivot point of meditation. You get to that stage and then you're off. So that's where I really want to get people, to be able to watch the breath and it's just so joyful. Having a wonderful time. Then I've done my job. It's like all downhill from there, in the sense of, you know, you pick up speed and it just happens automatically. Once that joy starts coming up. The reason I call it a pivot point, because once it starts to get joyful in your meditation, just watching the breath, having a great time, no more effort is required. You don't have to force yourself to meditate. You don't have to sort of try and say, "Oh, how many more minutes should I sit?" It's so natural. You love meditating, having a great time. You sit down there and you don't want to come up. You're having a beautiful experience. and the beauty is the glue which sticks the mind onto the object. This is the delight, the piti sukha. Having a great time, you don't want to go anywhere. Which means you're content, satisfied with whatever you're experiencing. Because you don't move, because the piti sukha holds you still, it creates more piti sukha, more joy. The stillness gets more energy. The energy creates more stillness, the stillness more energy, the energy more stillness, and it just builds up. And that's where you get the great meditations from. So, you get the piti sukha coming up, and then the next stage is actually to experience this whole, they call it, this interesting point, a citta sankhara, which is a mind-made thing. This is a mind-made bliss. It's not bliss coming from outside, it's coming from within the mind, from stillness of the mind. Mentioned that earlier on. When you're still, the energy goes into the knower, that part of the mind. It's energized. That's where you experience the citta sankhara, the mind-made happiness. And then, it all calms down. The mind-made happiness calms down, because that's still with the breathing, it's a beautiful breath. It calms down to the point that the breath disappears. Now those aren't stages which you do. Those are just like the layers of petals, it's just what happens. And sometimes you're halfway in between one stage and the next. Just like, you know, you're in this territory, the no man's land, you've gone through one immigration, and then another immigration. I was just thinking of an example, just like going across the causeway from Singapore into Johor. You know, you're neither in Singapore nor in Johor, you're on the bridge in between. There's many cases like that in meditation. You're in between one stage and another stage. It just develops seamlessly. You don't ask yourself, you know, what stage should I get to next? You stay where you are and it just develops, it unfolds. And then you are in this delightful place, because this is the eighth stage, the breath, the delightful breath vanishes, and what you're left with is just the delight. The best simile for this, now you're getting into some very refined stages of meditation, and it took me a long time to find a simile, but a simile came to me which is almost perfect, and that was from Alice in Wonderland. For those of you who know Alice in Wonderland, it was this really weird book done by this mathematics professor in Oxford. They all always are weird in Oxford. Cambridge is okay, but Oxford is a bit weird. That's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant book. And I quoted a lot from him. And the bit which I quote is a simile of the Cheshire Cat. And if those of you who know Alice in Wonderland, this great English little joyful little fantasy novel, whatever you might call it, that Alice saw this cat sitting in a tree, and a Cheshire Cat, it's got a smile on its face. And the cat suddenly disappeared, and then appeared again, and then suddenly disappeared again. Now this is very meditation-like, things vanishing which aren't supposed to vanish, but I'll come across that later on when I talk about insight. And then Alice said, you know, it quite gives me a headache seeing you coming and going so quickly. And so the cat said, okay, I'll vanish slowly for you. And then the cat started vanishing slowly. First its tail vanished. And then its legs, its paws vanished. And then its body vanished, leaving only its head. Then its ears vanished. Then its whiskers went. And then its head vanished, leaving only the smile. And Alice said, this is strange. I've often seen a cat without a smile, but never before have I seen a smile without a cat. And that was absolutely brilliant, because that's what happens. The smile, the piti sukha, without the breath. You've often seen the happy breath, but now you see the happy with no breath. Just left is the happiness, the joy, the piti sukha. Now many of you have seen the breath disappear and have gone into sort of that little dark space. Nothing's really happened there. You don't know what to do. One of the problems was that you didn't develop enough piti sukha, not enough joy. The happiness wasn't strong enough before the breath vanished. That's why, and one of the reasons why is because we think that that's not an important stage in the meditation. We watch the breath, we don't really care too much about the happiness. And I'm coming up and saying, no, the happiness is more important than the breath at this stage. So develop the joy in meditation, get into it. It's very difficult for Westerners to do this because you are afraid of happiness. Afraid of joy. There's a sense that you're emotionally out of control when you get that happiness. Some of you, not just one of you, a few of you, have had uncontrollable crying on this retreat. What the heck is wrong with that? You're afraid of it because you're out of control. Brilliant! It's about time you let go and stop controlling this world and controlling yourself and controlling your emotions. Let it come, for goodness sake. And even the happiness we're afraid of, because it's powerful. And we didn't make it. It's not ours. It's out of control. It just happens. And that is scary. Weird, you know, we're much more used and comfortable with suffering and pain and disappointment and frustration. We know that because we've had much experience of it. But when it comes to happiness, that's a bit weird. Especially really nice, intense happiness. How many times you've been happy and either sort of been afraid it's going to go, so you control it and it all vanishes? Or how many times you've been happy and been too excited, all fantasies? How many times have you had happiness and blown it, destroyed it? Why? Because we're afraid. It's marvelous at this stage. You overcome that fear, you just let happiness be. It's a wonderful thing to have that confidence or be told it's all right to be happy. That's why I've also given not just crying licenses, happiness licenses as well. I gave one out just the other day to one of the people who comes to the monastery. I gave him a happiness license. I allow you to be happy for any reason or for no reason at any time, at any place, signed Ajahn Brahm. That's funny, isn't it? But why? And it's really important. That actually helps him be happy, because that's, why do you need permission to be happy? Okay, that happens fast. So this comes up, and you have to give yourself that permission to be happy. So you get this beautiful happiness coming up in the meditation. And it just stays there. And then when that breath disappears, the happiness is what's left. And that is the power which makes you be able to experience the ninth stage of the Anapanasati. There's 16 stages, I'm only halfway, but the ninth stage is when you experience, this is how the Buddha said, you experience the citta, the mind. Now you all have heard the word mind, and you think you understand what the word mind means. It is just, that's it, just a label. It's just, yeah, I understand Paris, but you know, I've never been to Paris. So I've seen the pictures, I've seen people describe it, it's supposed to be the capital of France, they've got this little pointy monument somewhere, but if you've never actually been there, you don't really know it. The mind. You may think you know what it is, but only in that ninth stage do you really see it. You're face to face with it. What's happening here, as I mentioned earlier, focusing on the breath, early stage of meditation, everything else disappears. That's in the center of your screen. The sounds, yeah, they're at a distance. Feelings in the body, yeah, you can hardly feel them. When you really get into the delightful breath, that's so delightful, it's very hard to hear sounds. Very, very difficult to feel even the body, it's vanishing. And when that gets very, very strong, the five senses have gone. And that sixth sense, the mind, is what's literally covered up by the five senses. When you take the five senses out, that's what's left, the sixth sense. And that is one of the main purposes of this meditation, to get you the insight of what this mind actually is. Direct experience of this thing called your mind. You know what it appears like? It appears as this beautiful light. It's not a light. The visual sense is not working, but it's a mental object which you experience as a light. In exactly the same way as I said last night, when you die, you know, the sight is not working anymore. Ask any doctor, you're dead. the eye is not working. That's why one of the ways they find out if you're dead or not, they put sort of the light, you know, in your eye to see if there's any sort of movement there. No movement in the eye. Even the brain part of the eye, the visual part of the brain, is just not working at all. But people report seeing this beautiful light. This is a mental object. It's the way people perceive the mind. So that's why this comes up. This is actually that thing I call the nimitta, the sign of the mind, of the citta. This is what happens. This is what it feels like. And for those of you who've, you know, read lots of Buddhism and studied these suttas, Buddha kept on saying that this mind is radiant, you know, when the hindrances are all gone. And that's what it's referring to, that particular stage of meditation. Because you've let go of so many obstacles and now you're face to face with the mind, and it feels like this radiant moon or star or light or whatever. Sometimes it's like a screen with no particular locus, not a shape, but just a bright light covering the whole of your mental experience. These are real nimittas. This is that ninth stage of meditation, which is why I keep focusing on this. This is what the Buddha's taught in Anapanasati, the citta. And the 10th and 11th stages is that's when you brighten up that nimitta. That's the Abhipramojjhayang cittam. You actually start making it more and more radiant. And I'd say the next stage along with this, because they're linked together. It's not really stages, because some of these two things happen at the same time, is Samadhahang cittam, stabilizing, stilling that nimitta. Because sometimes you see these lights in the mind at that particular stage and it's flashing up. You can have, you know, the firework nimittas, as I call them, flashes of light and then disappearing. You can have, the other nimittas, which I get. You have the very complicated nimittas when you see, like, streams or sort of landscapes, forests or whatever. That's complicated nimittas. But the nice ones are the simple and bright and stable. In other words, it just stays there. Very beautiful, very stable. So the job of meditation is to brighten up and keep it stable. The most important thing is keeping it stable. And I gave you the clue a few days ago. The reason why that nimitta moves is because you're moving still. So it gives you that feedback. You're still, your nimitta is still. So after a while, you know, you're mindful enough, it's moving around, and you notice when it becomes less mobile. You've let go a lot. You've stopped reacting. You're still. And if you can follow that insight which comes from the feedback given by mindfulness, you learn, you train yourself how to be so still that that nimitta is totally still as well. It just doesn't move. It's just right there, lasting. Because you haven't moved. Now you have to be really, really still at this point. That's why it's a great test in developing very deep meditation. Spiders of movement and disturbs everything. You're training in deep states of stillness. Even any sort of movement at all, a slight sort of twitch, and it moves as well. And after a while you learn, you train yourself to be absolutely still. And that nimitta becomes still. That is the best way of brightening it up, because it's totally still, I mean really still, that's when energy really starts flowing into that nimitta, into that image in your mind, and it gets incredibly bright. Remember, when the energy is not being wasted doing things, it goes into knowing. And that nimitta comes incredibly, incredibly bright. Was it recently someone said they thought they were going to go blind? And I just laughed. I remember that experience. Sometimes so incredibly bright, you think, you just can't stand that such bright. That's like watching, like staring at the sun, you know. But, you know, sun at noon, really, really bright. But you mind, this is a mental image. It's nothing to do with the visual eye. You can take anything. You just keep on going. You don't go blind. You just, the mind gets incredibly happy and blissful. And that's just what happens. That's called the Abhipramojjhayang cittam, brightening up the nimitta. Joy, and giving it even more joy. And that becomes the 10th and 11th stages of Anapanasati. They say the 5th to the 8th stage, the Buddha said, that's completing the second Satipatthana on Vedana, on the sort of happiness pleasure part of Satipatthana. And the last three stages 9th, 10th and 11th, getting up the nimitta, brightening it up, stabilizing, that is the citta, satipatthana. Now this is what the Buddha said, now you've actually got the citta, the mind. And that's that third satipatthana you're practicing. Because you've got the mind right in front of you, that's what you're dealing with. That is that nimitta, it's the mind, the citta. So, when you've got that mind there, and you've got the citta there, it's bright, and soon you feel the usual experience is you feel yourself falling into that nimitta, that beautiful light, or it embracing you. Now your mind is totally free from the five senses. Before, yeah, it was powerful, but maybe sounds could just about come through, but now no longer. And what is left now is the sheer bliss of this. That is the object of your meditation in the jhanas. The first jhana, you really are blissed out. What I keep on saying, the bliss better than sex. But as one meditator said, he said, you are disparaging jhana by calling it a bliss better than sex. It's much better than that. It's way beyond that type of league of pleasure. And he's got a good point. But you've got to relate it to pleasures which people have experienced. This is the biggest pleasure of your many lives. So just saying that, it makes it incredibly enticing. And I do that on purpose. To say, yeah, it's well worth experiencing. Blows you away that such pleasure could exist. But it's not just for the sake of pleasure, but that's a pretty good thing to do. Why not? What's wrong with having fun? If you're going to have fun big time. If it's available, you know, why not? So this is on the menu for this retreat. First jhana, second jhana, fourth jhana. So why not? So, yeah, I'll have some of that, please. So this is what actually happens. And when you come out of those jhanas, then you've got the, was it the 13th, 14th, 15th, no, that's right, I didn't mention the 12th stage of the Anapanasati with Mochiyang Chittang. That means freeing the mind, liberating it, and that is always a simile for the jhanas. The 12th stage of Anapanasati is doing jhanas. The 8 vimokas, that's the word vimochiyang, same thing. And then when you come out of it, you have the last 4, the reflections of Anapanasati. Reflecting on anicca, reflecting on viraga, nirodha and patinisaga. I use the Pali words because the English words are quite inadequate. Anicca. People always think that means impermanence, but that doesn't really get to the heart of things. Anicca. The learning Pali myself, especially learning Pali, this is the language of those suttas, anicca is a Pali word. Learning it from the Vinaya, it's a very, very good place to start. The Vinaya, the monk's rules, because it put these words down in ordinary worldly usage, rather than metaphysics. This had a word, a meaning which everybody knew. This opposite is nicca. Nicca means regular. So we have a nicca talk every morning at 8 o'clock. It's a regular talk. We have lunch, it's nicca, at 11 o'clock. The sun comes up early in the morning, it's nicca, it's regular. Something you can rely upon. It's always there, it always happens. And anicca is irregular. Something which should be there, but it's not. Something which was always coming, and now is not. So much deeper than just rise and fall. As I'm going to mention later on, it is like you watch the waves on the lake go up and go down, rise and fall, and then you're watching those waves go up and down, rise and fall, and then you see the lake disappear. With all the land and the mountains and the sky around it, that goes too. Now that's anicca. Things which aren't supposed to go disappearing. That's the anicca. And that's what you reflect. There are things in those jhanas which you've just come out of have vanished, which shouldn't vanish, which have always been there, but now they're no longer there. Number one, the ache and irritation of a body. Look, I have to keep moving these days. My body is an irritation, and it's always there. Even when I'm asleep, I have to turn over, because it's always irritating. Now, it's gone. It's anicca. Hooray, I'm free in the jhanas. Me, Ajahn Brahm, is always here. I wake up and there I am again. In the jhanas, it's gone. Where's he gone? I don't know where he's gone. What's happened? Free, that's anicca. These are the things which actually vanish. So that's what we're talking about. And this is as clear as the nose on your face looking in a mirror when you come out of the jhanas. Something has vanished. So anicca is vanishing. Viraga is the fading away of things. Disappearing. That's why the Vedas book which I published was The Art of Disappearing. The Art of Viraga. Things vanishing. Fading away. Disappearing. All your suffering. Vanishing. All of the pain. Vanishing. The whole world. Disappearing. That's freaky. When you get into it, it's great fun. And of course, after Viraga, Nirodha, it ceased. It's gone. Nothing left. Total emptiness. Cessation. That is the scariest thing of all. You mean it all ends? I'm going to get a little poster, a little board on the end of a stick, and I'm going to walk around this retreat center with the placard, "The end is nigh. Nirodha is coming." This is the end of the world. It was right, 2012. It is the end of the world. For everybody who gets enlightened on this retreat. Cessation, nirvana. And lastly, patinissaka is like abandoning things. You know, like, we do get attached to things. We keep picking things up. But then you learn how to let go of things, to throw them away. Many of you came on this retreat with so much baggage. Please leave it here. Don't take it home with you. All of those pain of the past, all those difficulties, sicknesses, anger, guilt, grief. Please leave it here. Maybe we can actually, Daniel, can we get two big dustbins? Put grief, anger, guilt. See, how many dustbins do we need? There's actually a lot of problems, isn't there? And so when you leave, you can put it in the, and we'll just take it down the dump afterwards. Throwing things away. Those are the 12 stages of Anapanasati. That's actually how it works. And that's why I teach this way. That's how the Buddha taught it. That's how it works. And the most important reason I said this today was to focus on that happiness and joy part of the meditation. 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th stages of meditation. Please develop the happiness. Generate it. Cultivate it. When it comes, just don't throw it away as if it's something worthless or an obstacle. Cultivate it. During the day, if you feel like laughing, laugh. Smile, smile. Just if you feel like dancing, jumping up and down and singing, do it. Develop the happiness. Have confidence with your emotions, especially the positive ones. And then you find it's very easy to get into very powerful meditations. One of the big obstacles is we're afraid of the happiness. That's why people don't get as much jhana as they should. Go for it. Bliss out. You have a license issued by the Buddha. Any questions about the talk now? Yeah?
I feel one big obstacle is not believing that you can do it.
Ah.
Do you actually notice that? Or do you try and believe what you think?
You say, one of the big obstacles is believing I can't do it. And you know that was one of the reasons why not many monks taught jhanas. Because they thought, lay people. You can't do it. You're only a woman. Woman can't get jhanas. It was disgusting. You know, what you hear from some monks. And no, so, you know, being a rebel, you know, I'm a rebel on many areas, as you know, Ari. You know, when I was young, I always wanted to be a heretic. There's something really attractive to that. But anyway, so it's a question of why not? So I was one of the first ones to start teaching jhanas, as you know. I thought, let's give it a try, see if people can do it. And you know what I mean? Women can. They do. Many lay people have got jhanas. So, yes. To paraphrase Obama, yes, we can. We do it. So, you know me, I don't tell porcupines, except in jokes, but this is not a joke, that lay people do get jhanas. Big ones, too. So they do it. So it can be done, and you can do it.
So do you keep telling yourself you can, or do you just notice the book?
It's me. It's my job. I've got to market it and convince you, yes, you can. And I've just tried that by just saying other people have exactly the same as you. In the time of the Buddha, you read all these people were getting jhanas. What's the difference between then and now? No difference. Yes, you can. Go for it. Many people do it. But of course, if you say, I can't, that's the biggest obstacle. If you can't, then you won't. You can, then you will. It's only a matter of time. And people do get jhanas on these retreats. I give many examples of that. I already told that one example of that Malaysian lady. End of the retreat. Totally gave up. No way. Not even close to a jhana. And just an hour to kill. So I just go meditate. Nothing to do. And her attitude was perfect then. Not expecting anything. Not trying. Not doing anything. At last, you know, she did what she was supposed to be doing. And she let go. And she got this incredible deep jhana. And that was a wonderful experience for me to see that, because, you know, for me it's like, you know, you're a mum. When your kids get really successful, you're really proud. And then, you know, you guys are like my kids. So when you get something like that, I get really proud. And, oh, yeah, that's my disciple. They got jhana too. Yay! So, yeah, yes, you can. And now, of course, having convinced you can, this is how you do it. Give you all the tricks. Let go. Put it down. Become still all by itself. You just sit there waiting. And don't be afraid. Many of you get to stages and you get afraid. You don't want to go further because you're afraid of losing control. That's one of the biggest obstacles. You have to let go. Let go totally and bliss out. Very stupid. Why don't we just keep attaching to suffering? Any other questions or comments? Yeah?
How does one of us enjoy relating, or sort of, because one of us
don't like or dislike? No, quite a means you're at peace being blissed out. You're totally at ease being blissed out. You're equanimous to bliss. So if bliss comes, great. But the equanimity usually comes to the after. And even equanimity, the Buddha actually said it's the bliss of equanimity. It's a different type of bliss. Well, it's so still, it's just incredibly profound bliss. It's a very good point, because maybe one day I'll give a talk on those jhanas, but the difference between the first, second, third, fourth jhanas and the immaterial states is just a different flavour of bliss. Just like you've got chocolate ice cream, vanilla ice cream, strawberry, coffee ice cream. There's different like flavours of bliss. And as you get into these jhanas, you just realise how little people understand pleasure. And you're becoming the expert on pleasure as a monk. It's weird, isn't it? Because people think monks have no fun. Just little do they realise. We have so much fun. But, you know, understand the different types of blisses available to humanity, to the mind. And every bliss becomes just a... Look, when you get into a first jhana, you know, you think you're God, you think that's the essence, you think that's nirvana. There's no bliss higher than that. It's incredible. It's intense. That's why that when Christians, and it seems to be a few Christians got that first jhana, they thought that as union with God. Just pure love. The end. This is, you can't get more than that. And that sometimes if you get first jhana, you think, wow, this is incredible. This is it. And then you get a second jhana, you found, wow, there's a peak even higher than that. There's a bliss even higher than bliss. And then you get a third jhana, you think, gee, where does this end? And it just keeps on going. More and more refined bliss. And I'm not exaggerating, that's just how it feels. Okay, I think I've got you all motivated now. So, no more talking. Go off and do it. And anyone who gets enlightened today, or gets jhanas today, if you get jhanas today, I'll give you permission to go into town and get a nice dinner. That'll be your prize. That's a trick, because if you get into a jhana today, you just won't want a dinner.